Sorry, my name is Jackie Frostacki, Mayor of the City of Yarra, but I'm also asking the question as Deputy Chair of the Metropolitan Transport Forum of Councils. David, thanks for your presentation, and Jim, and noting the significant increase in capacity on the Monash Freeway that you've outlined in terms of 50%, with an expenditure of $1 billion. I want to ask about alternatives to that. Jim talked about the rollout of the smart bus, and one of the big gaps in the smart bus is the absence of a smart bus along the Monash Freeway. The $1 billion expended for a two-hour problem, but if you take both peaks, I suppose you could say four-hour problem in 24 hours. A smart bus, even at the peaks, might be, Jim could indicate, $500,000 expenditure to deal with that problem, which would be the main part of the 25% loss of productivity in terms of the congestions at that time. So it strikes me as a gap in the smart bus rollout that the Monash Freeway is has not been included in the schedule of rolling out. So I'd really like to hear your response on that.
Okay, I'll start if I may. I guess the thing that you're missing out of the equation there, Jackie, without being in any way critical of what you said, is that we have the Dandenong Rail Corridor running down pretty much parallel with the South Eastern Freeway, and that would have obviously very extensive capacity. You can get 1,000 people on a train as against 50 people on a bus, and so that Dandenong Triplication Project is the key public transport investment there. But we did actually look at the options for running high-frequency buses along the South Eastern Freeway, and the design of the freeway is not equivalent to, say, the Eastern Freeway. So in order to provide a decent journey time for a bus which is competitive with, say, a train, you have to do fairly massive amounts of capital expenditure, which make it more cost-effective to invest in the Dandenong Rail Line than in a smart bus. So smart bus is good for the orbital networks, and we will be investing very heavily in buses along the Eastern Freeway, but it's a little bit horses for courses where you've got the radial rail network lying alongside, because the carrying capacity of that is so much greater than a smart bus ever could be.
I'll just add quickly, Jackie, in looking at it, there were those issues. There's also the issue of journeys and where people are going, and we now know that most people who use Monash Westgate are travelling roughly 5 interchanges. It's only 2% who go from one end to the other. So we did have to, have a look at that. I think we ended up in the analysis, Jim, with about a bus every 30 seconds.
Yep.
And we weren't quite sure what we were going to do with them all when they arrived here. It was actually quite a serious consideration when you think of trains actually have those facilities to unload passengers in a well-designed place and then move on to collect another lot. It would have been quite difficult, even if the numbers had stacked up, to have to create that sized interchange in this particular area. So having spent probably some months looking at it, we decided on the options we've got.
I'm sorry, I actually missed the start of your presentation, so hopefully I'm not asking something that was already covered. I know the Melbourne City Council put out a blueprint on public transport about a month ago, and having heard a bit, spoken to the Department of Infrastructure since then, apparently there was no integration with the Victorian Government when they put that out. But in their statement, they commented on the ideal being a rail line out to Doncaster. Has that been contemplated at all?
It's been contemplated for many generations by a lot of people, a rail line to Doncaster. And first thing to say is the City of Melbourne work very closely with us. We have almost continuous engagement with the City of Melbourne, and I'm sure the same is true of Vic Roads. So they wouldn't have put out documents without having discussions with us, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the order of priorities for the City of Melbourne has to be identical to that of the state government, and that's just normal business. Obviously, Doncaster has the benefit at the moment and places beyond of a very high-frequency bus system or bus network along the Eastern Freeway. Now, that's not to say that it couldn't be improved, but during the morning peak there might be 50 or 60 buses coming onto Hoddle Street off the Eastern Freeway with quite good priority on the freeway. The option of building a rail link is not ruled out. It's been on the agenda for a long period of time. I guess it's quite complex once you start trying to take... You're building a railway line along the middle of a freeway. How do you get passengers to intermediate stopping points when it's in the middle of a freeway? And what do you do with the railway line once you reach Doncaster so you can actually target the population centres? It would involve quite extensive tunnelling. So the East-West study, which Sir Rod Eddington is going to be leading, is obviously going to look at mass transit options, public transport options, alongside more traditional road-based solutions. And links out to the east will be a key part of that by definition.
Thank you. Do you want to...
I should say there's about $35 million in this statement simply to improve bus services to Doncaster. So that with, you know, additional frequency, additional vehicles, expansion of the very successful park and ride facilities. So we'll be focusing on the bus solution and that's locked in. But Sir Rod Eddington will advise us whether there's something more grandiose around mass transit going forward.
Hello, I'm Connor King. I'm the Institutional Strategist for Victoria University. Again, about the smart bus network, the idea of the four semicircle network seems very useful. I'm just interested in the logic for, as far as I can see, all four start of the east in terms of development, work through the north and get to the west last. If there are four, why not start two on the west and two on the east and sort of share around the benefits during the earlier years?
I think I'm not really sure of that. You'd have to go back into ancient history to, well, not ancient history in an Alexander the Great sense, but a few years back to work out why Blackburn, Springvale, Warrigal Roads, etc. were selected as matters of priority. I'd say the next cab off the rank, if I can use that expression, will be the link between Box Hill and Altona. Now, obviously, very few people are going to travel on a bus between Box Hill and Altona, but it'll provide high-frequency services on an arterial basis through the west. The inner west is actually reasonably well provided with bus services, and that may have been part of it. It's also the issues around congestion and road space allocation may be more complex in the west. But I might give David an opportunity to contribute.
Yeah, I think the second last thing you said is sort of relevant. To some degree, have to take into account existing facilities and, I guess, by implication, existing gaps. And there's been enormous growth in all parts of the metropolitan area, but probably more sustained and, as far as public transport goes, perhaps unsatisfied growth out in the east. It'd probably be arguments either way, to be honest. But at this stage, that's the plan. And I guess over a period of time, we need to monitor how we go. But we have to start somewhere.
Dan Fundy.
Here he goes.
Yes, Dennis Cleese, Aero Trams. Not surprisingly, I have a question about trams. You glossed over a little quickly on the tram side of it, but I was wondering if you could comment on some of the challenges that tram has faced over the last couple of years,
sure.
Particularly given that the amount of focus and investment in transport and livability on trams and changes that we need to make, and just look for some of your reactions to what sorts of challenges we see in the future.
Okay, well, we'll both be able to answer that one because we're both... very interested and engaged in trams. I think I actually stuffed up because I missed the slide altogether. It wasn't that I just completely forgot about the tram system, Dennis. One of the main challenges, probably the main challenge facing the tram system, is that 65% of the tram system shares road space with private cars. And some of you may have heard me say before that if you go to France and look at all the tram systems across all French cities, the total length of tram track where that's the case is 800 metres, so significantly less than the length of Collins Street. And as the tram system is located in the inner 15 km's of Melbourne, where road congestion is at its greatest. And as car use increases, we see trams slow down. And as trams slow down and become less predictable, it's harder to persuade inner-city residents that they should use the tram for the journey to work, and therefore they get in their cars, and you can see a vicious circle beginning to develop. So we have to press on with the Think Tram program, which is a kind of toolkit of different solutions, ranging from giving traffic signal priority to trams, physically separating cars from trams, building platform stops which enable people to get on and off trams more quickly. And if we can get the tram from A to B more quickly, then it can turn back from B and start heading back to A, and we improve frequencies, which is what commuters like as well. It's pretty tough going, this Think Tram program, where you're trying to do something on a whole-of-city strategic basis but having to deal through councils with local retailers that only really see the parking spot outside their shop. But it's a battle that has to be won, otherwise the tram system will slowly but surely die a death of 1,000 cuts.
And Dennis, while you're around, we know it won't happen because the three of us form a task force that enjoys grappling with this sort of issue. What I wanted to add to that is that I think Melburnians sort of love trams, and whilst they're all different colours these days, it still is a huge feature of the city and a very efficient form of transport. We often say, if you can imagine a kilometre of cars full of people who are commuting, and that's not a crime, but if you can imagine a kilometre of stationary traffic, you're looking at the same number of people that fit into about two-thirds of a tram. That's just a sort of an odd little benchmark to keep in mind, but I also said earlier that if we could just shift even 6%, makes a huge difference. But we do have to look at where we've got these conflicts between tram routes, and my understanding, Dennis, of trams is they can't dodge things very well. When they do, you get upset because they've fallen off a track. But so what we've really got to look at is where are the conflicts, and can we provide for conflicting vehicles or conflicting use some other way? And we are discovering ways to do that collectively. We are creating bicycle routes in parallel roads. We are looking at freight programs that will, make it easier for heavy vehicles to avoid tram routes, etc. And Jim mentioned the Think Tram program, and we collectively, Dennis, should just give it a little plug. We've just completed over 200 projects in that program together. And whilst there's some very tough stuff, we rely heavily on our local government colleagues to help us get through that so that we can really make a huge difference.
And it's worth adding, Dennis, just since you've turned up and asked me a question, I think notwithstanding the problems we've described, Yarra Trams has achieved a 35% improvement in the punctuality of the tram system in the last 6 or 7 years. The trams are clean. The super stops are going up around the city. I was using the new one in Spencer Street yesterday. The operation of the system is taking more advantage of information and communications technology. I really like those little things you're putting at the tram stops where you can see when the next tram's going to turn up. So, and things like your fleet operations centre. So Yarra Trams is doing an excellent job, but it needs strategic support from the government, from Vic Roads, and from local councils, and from community groups.
Gentlemen, a little three topics, but just one question. Peter Cronwell from Opius. Topics I wanted to ask about was the interchange at the docks and how that's going to be improved with the various systems that you're talking about to get the containers out and moving as quickly as possible. Or the other one that might be interesting is just how far do we go in creating Australia's biggest car park at Tullamarine, because it keeps on expanding, and should we have a train system or some other system to help minimise that? But let's make it easy. Let's talk about price sensitivity for ticketing systems on the public transport system. During the Commonwealth Games, of course, the freebie ticket system seemed to work exceptionally well, and everyone claimed that that was the only way to run it, make it all free and everyone will go on it. But, of course, the debate showed that that's not exactly true. Could you give us some of the latest thinking, particularly sure. from Europe or Canada, on what the price sensitivity strategies that could be utilised to help with this demand management?
You have to ask Dennis about the latest thing from Canada, because he's just come back from there. generally speaking, what the Commonwealth Games was successful in the ways in the way that David has described. A lot of that was to do with restrictions on car parking in the CBD, I suspect, rather than just price sensitivity. If you, I'm aware that the Age, or the Sunday Age rather, was running a campaign to make public transport free, and that's something that's been kind of informally looked at. It would take large resources out of public transport to do that. But worse still, it seems to me that the price elasticity, or the really dominant price elasticity in public transport, is quality of service rather than price. And this has been demonstrated, for instance, when we were talking about Smart Bus earlier on, and a 40% increase in patronage on I think it was Blackburn Road. Providing improved frequency and reliability is the thing that will get people out of their cars and onto public transport, and price pretty much comes second to that. So there are, quality of service is a more cost-effective way of delivering the same outcome. Having said that, I think with the new ticketing system, smart card-based ticketing system coming in 2007, which is a $500 million project in its own right that didn't even make the cut in terms of that presentation, we will have a system which is capable of sending more sophisticated price signals to people. So we may be able to provide significant discounts for off-peak travel, which combined with higher frequencies for trains in the shoulder peaks might begin to smooth out some of the congestion that we see during the peak period. And we also, with smart cards, give people the benefit of travelling without having to understand an extremely complex ticketing and fares system. They don't have to work out whether they want to buy a two-hour or a daily or a weekly. So there are all kinds of passenger benefits from there. But with smart card, we can start thinking and acting in a slightly more sophisticated way about the pricing of public transport.
Thank you. Jim, question to you. It's been a good history lesson so far, but history often says that there's other sectors of the community that are overlooked in the transport, and that in particular is the people who are ageing and disabilities. And the problem with the history of that is that it's been so disjointed as to who's responsible for it within both the government and the normal sector of the community. Is it envisaged that ultimately public transport will take full responsibility for the movement of the ageing population and the people with disabilities? I'm not talking just the low-floor trams, etc. There's a whole fleet, a whole range of vehicles out there at the moment moving thousands of people a day that can't get to where they have to under any other circumstance, and most of them have to privately fund and never come under public transport. They don't come under the DOI. They come under various other sectors of the government. Are we going to drag that together somehow, that no longer are those people going to be disadvantaged by the current transport situation?
I guess the first thing that we have to do in public transport is to provide a public transport system which meets the needs of a wide section of the population. And I was talking about what we're going to do for the bus system, which will be revolutionary. 70% of people using buses are the elderly or young people. And if you look at the areas where transport disadvantage is greatest, it maps pretty closely onto social disadvantage more generally. And that explains why many municipalities have seen improved public transport as being the best way of addressing social disadvantage, full stop. As far as the community sector is concerned, I think the answer probably lies in the flexible transport solutions agenda, which involves my division, public transport division, coordinating the activities of other government departments so that we actually broker local solutions on the ground. If we can see a transport need, we would look at community buses, we would look at school buses, which might be lying idle for large parts of the day. We'd look at wheelchair-accessible taxis and try and broker local solutions for local communities. So, yes, we will play a coordinating role in all of that. That doesn't mean that we're going to take over the community sector and start telling them or the Department of Human Services how to do their job. But there is clearly a need for improved coordination, and we've put our hands up to do that.
Ian Stewart, Resolve. Are you feeling or have you anticipated a move that the increased petrol prices are going to have with people moving less on David's roads and more on Jim's public transport? And the second part of my question is, exactly when are we going to stop putting metal coins into machines on trams to get a ride?
Well, the answer to your second question is 2007, provided you take up the opportunity to have a long-life smart card. If you don't, you'll still have the option of standing there dutifully putting your coins in a machine to buy a short-term smart card. But the smart thing to do will be to get a long-term smart car. Do you want to do the one about petrol?
Yeah, look, it's... I guess it's a bit of a moving feast in that the information is sort of somewhat lagging the actual petrol pump price. But we are, and I want to try to stick to facts and not predictions or what various people think is happening. I think the major fact at the moment that we can pick up is through our vehicle registration data. And we are seeing and this has been reported not from our data but from vehicle manufacturers' data, but we are seeing a significant reduction in purchase of large vehicles, and we are seeing still a very, almost compensating increase in the purchase of small vehicles. Now, if petrol prices continue to increase, there's all sorts of opinions out there as to exactly what that will mean. But at this stage, we're still predicting about a 1.2% increase in vehicles per annum. But I think if the current global situation were to change, then maybe something different will happen. People will have to make their own decisions, I guess, about how they spend their money. But one thing is for sure, that people will still need transport, and hopefully we can all work to make it the more sustainable type.
It's worth adding that because cars have about 90% market share, it doesn't take much of a displacement from cars to have a dramatic impact on the number of people carried on public transport, which is probably why we've seen what we estimate at this stage to be an 11% increase in patronage on our suburban train system in the last 12 months.
Hi, Jim. Justin DiGiulio from the Department of Justice. You both touched on earlier about safety on the transport network. I was wondering if you could touch on a bit more detail about safety around the transport system overall and some of the initiatives you're looking at.
Okay, I might start with by talking about the railways. I'll treat your questions if you're talking about operational safety, which is accidents, and then come on to talk about personal security. The government's just put through the most progressive legislation on public transport safety or on rail safety just in the last few months, and Ian Shepherd is here somewhere, the guy in my division who put that legislation through. And Victoria's really led the way on this issue. We've established an independent safety regulator, we've established a new risk-based assessment regime, new accreditation requirements. We've basically revolutionised the way in which public transport safety is being treated. And continues on from there, and in most cases you'll find that Victoria is providing national leadership on these issues. As far as personal security is concerned, we always look at staffing, we always look at lighting, we always look at CCTV, and obviously there's a whole stream of work around counter-terrorism measures, which I won't go into now because we don't have time. But I would say this, that the actual recorded crime on the system, the trends in it and the level of it, is out of all proportion or out of all whack with people's perceptions. People have a much dimmer view of their safety on public transport. And the people who tend to have the dimmest view are people who don't use it. Regular users of public transport regard it as pretty safe, and they are familiar with the system and they're comfortable with it. The problem for us as policymakers is it's the people who only use it occasionally or who don't use it at all that we need to shift onto public transport, which is why we have to take their perceptions very seriously, even if the statistics show that crime on public transport's fallen by about 30% in the last 4 years.
And if I can add, just because I took it as a broad question, not only looking at security but looking at the potential for injury, there are a number of initiatives happening looking at the users of public transport who, of course, at before and after the use are pedestrians, and we've known for some time that a large number of pedestrian injuries occur in the central part of Melbourne, just behind us here, and therefore the design of the super stops for trams takes safety into account in that you will know that some of the older safety zones, which essentially simply had a small space for people to alight and get on trams and mill about, and a sort of a railing and a concrete block, if you like, at the end, they are by no means the best we can do, whereas the super stops are, and we will see a reduction in injuries. In the rest of the network, we've developed new standards for bus stops, new standards for tram stops. You'll be seeing rolled out a lot of special paving at tram stops, red paving to indicate where pedestrians and other vehicles can conflict. There's some of those already happening. Some of you may know about that. And we're also just reviewing the road rules nationally, and there are two other states that have trams, but road rules for buses and trams to, again, try and improve safety. And that'll have to be, if there are changes, they'll have to obviously have to come with some major community, education programs, which hopefully we'll see.